So the title of the talk is From Disconnection and Isolation to Connectedness and Empathy. And I want to start by saying that if we feel lonely or isolated, this is the tip of the iceberg. It's the tip of the Kirchhorn, because underneath there is a deeper isolation which is very fundamental to being a human being and to being a self. And in some way we are all suffering from a deep alienation. Even if we feel very connected to our friends and family, we feel loved and so on. And very often we're not. We're not loved so much, and we need more love, and we need more. But if you think about it in terms of, for example, our need to be seen by others, that starts from childhood, and you realize how important that is in a child, that a child is seen. Someone out there sees this child and knows this child. And I think kind of a really big part of the Ritalin generation of today is kids that are not fully seen. So they're all the time running to be, you know, noticed or to feel themselves known by the world, or to know there's something there that is so restless. And, you know, not being listened to deeply, not being seen. I remember that was very painful in my childhood. I had a loving home, but no one was really listening to me. I just had, there was no one there that could listen. There was just other universe, generation gap, you know, of the previous generation and post-war. There was just a whole other world. I was living in a total universe different from. And there is this sense that even where there is connect, we're connected with people, we have a chevra, we even have a sangha. We're not understood, and especially, you know, places we work in, the family, the more distant family, they're not, maybe not like us, and we get the sense that there is a lack of understanding, a lack of real connection. So it actually affects everybody, this kind of alienation, in one way or another. It's very, very unusual if we really, really get that deep being seen, being listened to. Even the spiritual life, we're doing our Dharma practice, we're in a sort of Buddhist world, and we may have a partner that at the best says, well, don't understand what you're doing. Leave me alone. Don't talk to me about Buddhism. And, you know, and so immediately, or maybe even to say, I accept what you're doing, but I don't understand any of it. So already, you know, there is no one really to talk to about this. So we have to look for a sangha. But in a sangha, it's once every month we have a cup of tea together in the Beta Sangha with somebody. It's still not enough, really. So we have, if we're lucky, we can have a very fruitful sangha. We have a group, we have people we talk to, we can sit having cups of coffee with people and really sharing from the heart, and then we become seen and heard. But it's not so easy. And I think in our practice, we can often feel that it may not help with all of this. We may feel that our practice is quite private and secluded in us, and that it's kind of almost like a secret that we keep, that we go away for and go and retreat for, and we can't explain to anybody what we did, what happened to us there. Maybe we shouldn't also. the practice doesn't always help with this. The more practice we do, we don't necessarily. Sometimes we can feel isolated, alienated, even if we practice quite deeply. And so there's a question: how to move out of ourselves in expression, in connection. What do we do when we meet someone that thinks so differently from ourselves? We meet a right-wing settler who we happen to grow up with, doesn't understand, you know, just a whole universe different from us. What do we do with that? Do we withdraw, keep in our own box? What do we do? How do we go out with our practice? So, I would say that a lot of the Dharma practice that we have experienced in the Dharma up to now, and especially at the beginning, is a kind of antidote, a trufa neged. It's an antidote to pizur, scattering. It's an antidote to being, to running. It's an antidote to other people controlling us and telling us what we have to think and what we have to do. It's an antidote to all the time being out, being running, doing, functioning, being busy, being having to listen to everybody and believe everybody and believe what people tell us and so on. And so this movement of going back inside home is really, really important and is very much the basis of the Dharma for us and the beginning of the Dharma for us. It's really important to find that inner space. And what it does is not only find ourselves a truth inside, where all the time when we're out, like the chevra and the radio and the television and all the things that people are thinking, talking, we come back and we find a truth here. And that movement is really important of internal truth. There's we find the truth, as the Buddha said, the whole of the world. The Buddha mentioned this very clearly in discussing with someone that said to him, a sadhu said to him, I walk thousands of kilometers and I never reach the end of the world. It's all the same world, same boring, difficult, problematic world. And the Buddha said, well, you've gone in the wrong direction. You'll never reach the end of the world by walking. You'll never get there, because the whole world is in this 2 meter long body. And there is the beginning of the world and the end of the world as well. You will find it in this 2 meter long body. So you don't need to walk anywhere. And indeed, we need to go inside to find that. And we need to shut our eyes and withdraw and be secluded a bit and close ourselves a little bit, because it's really important, you know, we can't do it if we are still trying to be in the chevra and television and think that somehow we can find our subtle, quiet, deep truths that way. So we need to shut the door, and it's a bit artificial to go on retreat, but it's really important. It makes that balance, and it shuts a little bit the input, which is too much. So it closes down a little bit the volume, the otzma of input all the time that we're getting. So that's a very important, and it helps us also to become aware of who we are, which is also difficult in the middle of the craziness of the outside world, which is constantly trying to make us who we are and push us to be labeled and be somebody. So we can learn more by quietly looking inside who we are, who we are not. We can look at beliefs, which otherwise, again, we'd be out in the world, we'll never look at them, because everybody's, we are just expressing them. We can see how we construct our world, how we build our world. We can see what our thoughts are made of, what our body's made of, and what our feelings are made of. All of that is quite an internal work. And inside work. And it gives us a basis, it gives the ground for us. Even what I said before about alienation and loneliness, we might not notice it unless we look inside and we see, wait a minute, there is a withdrawal happening here, and it's painful, a loneliness, alienation, isolation. Okay, fine, but we see it inside, and we don't notice it otherwise. And so, inside, moving inside is really important. Closing the gap between me and myself. Who was it? Jack Cornfield said, I don't know who it was, maybe not Jack. Sometimes we feel something is really missing in our lives. When we meditate, we know we ourselves were what was missing. It's not something else that was missing. We were missing ourselves. and so we need to go back inside to see that we're not missing ourselves. We found ourselves. And there is peace. And a sense of shlemut, sense of completion, a sense of roga, of returning to ourselves. So, and that's what we're doing in the beginning especially, and it's really, really important. And the Buddha described this in the word viveka. Viveka is seclusion. Now, maybe, did I talk about this? I can't remember if I talked about this at all. No? So, viveka is seclusion. It means exactly that, to shut out the world. And kaya viveka is seclusion of the body. It means exactly what he said at the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. Go and sit under a tree. Don't start in Rukhav Dizengor. You can get there, but start under a tree. Start meditating on a retreat. He said it. Start going into an empty building and just sitting quiet. Start by reducing the neediness for the world. And this is viveka. It's seclusion. It's going into the cave a little bit. Because at the beginning you really need to have that sense of, in order to look deeply, we need to stop being a little bit, reduce the amount of pulling, pushing, in, you know, as I said, influencing and the madness of the world. So this is beautiful, and it brings us to a big place in us. But there is a space where seclusion can be painful, and that's when it turns into something too much, where we feel closed in, too internal. And at that point, we need to learn to practice in the middle of Rukhav Dizengor. And that means the medicine we needed has worked, and we are ready for the next stage, which is being much more meditation and practice, being in the world, and not viveka. I have to say that viveka, seclusion, which is the basis of monasteries, the basis of retreats, the basis of quietness, it's, you know, shutting our eyes, looking inside, it goes quite deep. Viveka seclusion of the body, but then it goes into seclusion of the mind, meaning that our mind is secluded, we watch our mind, we hold our mind like a vessel, kamo kli, and we look at it, and viveka of the self, in which the self is secluded. So it's like we're watching the self as it arises, and we're secluded in a way from the a kind of automatic being somebody. We go back in and we look at the self. So there are layers of viveka, but usually the one we talk about is the body, and the body means sitting under a tree and not sitting in the middle of the Tachana Merkazit for the beginning. And so in order to go out, the most essential thing that we need to develop is empathy, empathic awareness. And so I really want to talk a bit about this. What is empathy? Empathy is a feeling. It's an intuition. It's not a thought. It is not a concept. It is immediate. It is a way we're aligned. We are connected with. It's something that's happening on quite a deep level. It's a kind of, it's something that is under the conceptual mind. But it connects us in a very, very deep way. And I just had, yesterday and day before yesterday, my wife Rachel was in tears, and she grew up with someone. She was in school or in youth with someone called Uri Elitzur, and I think there was a bit of a romantic thing there as well, so she was, and then yesterday she was crying when he died. Now, he's big time fascist, totally, you know, the other end of my wife's views. There could not be anything more different than that. That he's also a big time chauvinist, a big time egoist, a big time Schwitzer, all the things that my wife is absolutely can't bear. And she's in the other end of the spectrum totally. And she was crying because, and I asked her, we talked about this quite deeply, and she said, it's because I see him. I haven't met him for 30, 40 years, but I've seen him. I see the way his inner world has led him to these places of extremism, I see the way his inner world works, and how his inner life has brought him to be a Schwitzer, this, or this, or this, or this, or his whole kind of inner nature. And we were very close in that level, and far away at the level of concept and thought and all of this. And I'm just giving that as an example, how empathy is what's behind the screen. Ma mi acharei haklaim. What is behind the whole, this person? What's behind the eyes? And that's can only be seen by this immediate knowing, intuitive, aware knowing of the sense of the person. It's a sensing empathy. It's a sensing. You sense what's going on with this person. Like a mother with a child, if the child needs empathy, the child doesn't need to be listened. the chokhmot of the child, which is often, I think, the kind of the Ritalin phenomena. I was once in a lift. Well, may I'll talk louder. I was once in a lift in a building, and I saw a guy and a father who was busy with his telephone, and then he had a young boy next to him, and the boy was constantly talking about what he discovered in the computer. I could do this, and if I press this button, then this happened, and I press this button, and that happened. And the father was paying no attention at all, was looking in there, and the child was, like that. And this disconnection was total. And I could feel that the child was saying all these things to win the attention, that he never got, and the agitation that Nat needed. He was trying to win the father. The father couldn't be found, in a way. And all of the empathy is under that, is where you don't need to say how clever you are, how good you are, what you are, it's when you're seen directly. And that's very quiet. That can be very quiet. And that's in the eyes and behind the eyes. And there is real connection. It's not in time. Because of my, you know, interest in recently in neurobiology from NAVA and this project with IDC, and I sort of was reading quite a bit more about the brain, and we were talking about mirror neurons, which are built very early on in childhood, even in animals, where there's a neuronym in the brain that are just mirrors of the world. And we don't know that they work, how they work. I mean, they're not conscious. They're just mirroring the world constantly. And our behavior and our feelings are under the radar, and they're flowing. And I think that if we let them, then it's fine. But usually we shut them down, or we bring in our, you know, disconnections, and then it's like that father with the boy. And if we don't, and then it's painful if we don't allow the mirror neurons to work freely. So they get covered over, the empathy gets covered over by logical thinking, by not pain and not being listened to and then having to have so many words, by sitting on the television for hours and screens, and compensations, by fears, by anesthesia, emotional anesthesia, emotional hardama, all of that will shut down the empathy. Mindfulness can open it. And mindfulness with some sense of steadiness, I would say. Because you need a bit of steadiness to look into life and other people. It's a counterbalance to fear, because we have a lot of fear in relation to others. So the steadiness, the sense of mindfulness with some sense, which is perhaps concentration or inner peace, some sense of steadiness where we're ready to look at others in the world. We're not frightened and so on. So mindfulness with some steadiness or some confidence or some yitzivut or inner peace, the two together work fine to reconnect us in the world of, you know, emotional intelligence, if you like. It's mindfulness will show us the way to empathy and emotional intelligence. Mindfulness will show us the songs that people are singing inside, and this leads me to want to play you a song. And it's just very coincidental that in the last few days we remembered Rachel and I, and also one or two of my daughters, we remembered the music that we used to listen to a lot, starting the end of the 60s, of the Incredible String Band. And I don't think anybody probably here has anything to do with the Incredible String Band, because they're late 60s kind of hippy-happy, hoppy, psychedelic folk, English folk. But they have beautiful, beautiful songs. They are written with this idealistic 60s, innocent, innocence. So one song that really just says what this message, I want to play it to you, if I can understand how to. It says "Stand By." So
supposed to look.
If you stand by,
stand by.
It's what?
Yeah,
he's standby to chasot on.
No, he's pressing on.
Uh-huh. Or operate.
Reading.
Let's see.
Okay, it might work now. Yeah, just a second, just a second. It might work. Oh, here it goes.
No, okay.
Yes, yes, yes.
I want the next one. Right, oh. It's not this one.
I'll put the volume on.
Rega. Ah, okay. Now you can.
I'm not the kind to complain that I never had a girl to love. Man, if I'm a girl, I tried hard to know, but I think I never tried enough. Sitting one day by myself and I'm thinking what could be wrong, when this funny little hedgehog comes running up to me and it starts up to sing me this song. Oh, you know all the words and you sung all the notes, but you never quite learned the song she sung. I can tell by the sadness in your eyes that you never quite learned the song. Every day when the sun go down and the evening is so very still, many fine girl I've held in my arms, and I hope there's many more that I will. But just when everything is going fine and absolutely nothing is wrong, this funny little hedgehog's always around, and every time he wants to sing me this song. Oh, you know all the words and you sing all the notes, but you never quite learn the song she sung. I can tell by the sadness in your eyes that you never quite learned the song. One day when the moon was full, I thought I might settle down. Found myself a pretty little girl and I stopped all my running around. Just when the preacher come along and he's just gonna pop on your ring, this funny little hedgehog comes running down the aisle. I don't have to tell you what he did sing. Oh, you know all the words and you sing all the notes, but you never quite learn the song she sung. I can tell by the sadness in your eyes that you never quite learn the song. The kind to complain that I never had a girl to love. Many fine girl I've tried hard to know, but I think I've never tried enough. But now I'll be looking all my days, and it isn't just me I gotta please. There's this funny little hedgehog who's always around, and the only words he ever sings to me are these. Oh, you know all the words and you sing all the notes, but you never quite learn the song she sung. I can tell by the sadness in your eyes that you never quite learn the song. I'm not the kind to complain.
Incredible string band.
String band,
yeah. They've got loads of, I mean, tons of albums, and they're really great. They're amazing band, very poetic, and I used to love to listen to them all the time. But I mean, I think this song just expresses very beautifully. We can learn the notes and the tune and the this, but we don't catch the song. This can be of another person. We just don't catch the song. What song are they singing? what's the music in their soul? What's the music under? What's the song? How are we going to put ourselves in other people's shoes with empathy? It's not enough to go on meditation retreats then. Something maybe else is needed here. How are we going to, for example, how to learn how we affect other people? What effect do we have on others? This is not so easy. Not only will others affect us, how we affect others, how they are with themselves, how we are with them. All this dynamic needs a kind of empathic awareness. So, I think we can see that mindfulness for us needs to start to go out. And awareness needs to start to go out. And we need, this is 24 hours awareness. This is about being out of the meditation mode and getting into a habit that our mindfulness is about closing the eyes and shutting the door. And that's a bit of, that can become a habit. And we maybe don't need that. I mean, we need it for sure, but we don't need that to be the only place. We don't need to get into that kind of definition that that's what the spiritual practice is. We need to pay attention to mindfulness out in the world, as well as in. And actually, that's also in the Satipatthana Sutta. The Buddha said, pay attention to the body in and the body out. Means out, others' bodies, your body and other people's bodies, your mind and citta and others, citta in, citta out. It's right in there in the Satipatthana Sutta, all the time. Every time the Buddha talks about mindfulness, he says mindfulness internally and mindfulness externally. And as I say, we got so far by, you know, a sense of antidote to go inside is really important, but I think we just need to make the balance. Now maybe some of you already do more, made that balance and have a lot of practice of mindfulness out as well as in, and so it can be very individual. And some people don't have a problem with the definition of spiritual practice as being rather internal. But others can get too much viveka. And partly because the world is threatening. And that's why mindfulness with some basis of steadiness, of equanimity, will help us to go out, to be less afraid of the world. And they work together. To be less afraid of the world will help us to see out others and so on. And seeing others will help us to be less afraid of the world. So we have this, a little bit like the story of Rachel and Uri Elitzur. We see someone who is angry and aggressive to us or whatever, or someone close to us. If we can develop a little bit of that steadiness, we will then be ready to look at that person in the eyes and see and allow our empathy to reach out to that person, to connect and see where that person's coming from, rather than being reactive and being afraid of that person or that situation. So they work together. The mindfulness can help us reduce our fears, and our steadiness can help us be mindful of the other. So instead of being reactive and instant and having an armor, a shirion, and oh, they're attacking in some way, or strangers or some way, or not understanding me and making troubles for me in some way, we can go on this process where through the development of mindful attention to the way they are and listening to the song of this person and reaching into their shoes, we become less reactive, less afraid. They can't do that much to us. We're with their inner nature. So they work together. There's a nice text which I used a lot in the peace work, because this is also the area of conflict, but the conflict is a big subject, and I won't talk about it now. But this text is interesting, that the Buddha said, well, someone asked the Buddha, how do you talk to someone that is really different from you and angry and doesn't listen to you, has strong views and so on? The Buddha said, look, if there's someone who doesn't have strong views and doesn't have strong emotions at that moment, it's very easy to talk to them. If they have strong views but no strong emotions, or strong emotions like anger but not strong views, it's not easy to talk to them. It's tiring, but you can do it. In other words, someone has very different views from you, strong views, but they're not very emotional. So it's possible. Or if they're very emotional about something, but their views are not very strong, just emotions, it's possible, but it's difficult. But the Buddha said, if they have strong views and strong emotions, like half the time in the Israeli streets, that's what you experience. People with strong views and strong emotions. The Buddha said, don't bother. But there's this bottom line to this text. The Buddha said, never underestimate the power of equanimity in those situations. The power of your inner equanimity. And I might have told you the story before, because I never know who I tell stories to and who I didn't, about one of the Palestinian dialogues that I was leading with Rauda. And at a certain point, and it was we really worked to keep steadiness and quietness, even though there were people with a lot of pain and emotion, and a lot of very, you know, there were soldiers and Israeli soldiers and Palestinian people from street boys together in the same room talking together. It was very taun, the situation. But usually it was really okay. And we did a lot of investment in keeping things quiet and friendly and warm and trying to melt. But I remember one time the whole thing blew up and everyone was screaming at everybody else and blaming everybody else. You're killing my families, you're a terrorist. The whole thing just blew up for about 5 minutes. And I just felt I lost it completely. I just couldn't control this. And I just sat there and sort of basically meditated and just sat in my chair and waited for it to settle down somehow. After 5 minutes, it all settled down. And Rauda, she was the Palestinian co-facilitator, I turned to her and said, I'm sorry. I just blew it. I couldn't hold this thing. It just blew up. I'm sorry. And so I took it on myself. And she said, no, no, you don't understand. Your equanimity, sitting there quietly in the chair, stopped this thing after 5 minutes. It could have gone on and on and on and on. It could have led to violence. Your equanimity actually stopped it. And I didn't notice that. But maybe it was there. But on reflection, this text told me something about that situation like that. That where you really can't talk to somebody because of emotions and strong views, then equanimity or steadiness can be a quite a powerful tool, and it works under the surface. So, mindfulness going out is a shift. And what I'm inviting you to do is be more aware of mindfulness in our daily life by being more aware of applying mindfulness out into the world, into how others are. It's practice. When you get on a bus, be mindful of what do you think the bus driver's feelings are? How is the bus driver relating to you? On what is the feeling messages that the bus driver is getting from you? or the waitress in the cafe, or the vegetable man in the makolet, or your family and friends or people in the workplace. So it's a practice of being out with our mindfulness, of checking how we are at every minute and how others are with us. And it's a kind of intimacy, just like we're used to intimacy with the breath, going out is intimacy with the world. And it needs some attention, it needs practice. And it shows, if we do this, we get a feeling of a lot of joy, because it's expanding. It's expanding our consciousness into the world. So we see a dog passing by, we actively, like a practice of meditation, we ask ourselves how that dog is feeling.
Can I have a question?
Can we leave it to the end? Do you mind? I'll be a little bit longer and then we finish. It needs action and intention, because we sometimes forget it. It's very easy to forget. And so when we expand ourselves to be out, we feel expanded, we feel something joyful, we feel something connected. When we feel contracted and withdrawn, we always feel pain. It's a very, obviously dukkha here is a good message for us. And we can, because empathy is very natural and part of nature, and I mentioned the mirror neurons, we can trust it. We can trust ourselves. We can trust that contact with, I mean, you know, it's very simple. You go out in the street and there is a dog that's barking. I mean, talking about dogs. And maybe that's your question, but because I mentioned dogs. But anyway, we'll see that. But you can go out in the street. I mean, in Khalil, there's loads of dogs and they're barking all the time. But I really learned, right at the beginning of my life in Khalil, which I'm not used to dogs, come from the city, and they come out racing out of houses, barking at me as I go past. And then none of them have any chains or leads or whatever. They're all running free. So I'm racing out of houses. I really learned to be mindful of the way they are. And the mindfulness of the way they are. Is their tail wagging? How are they really in the eyes to me? What are the habits that they learned, these dogs? What habits are they acting? Their instincts. How they are, the instincts. What kind of, and therefore then what do I need to tell them? From the mindfulness of the way this dog is, the way it moves, how, if it's aggressive or not aggressive, what do I need to tell them, to say to them, to manifest? I know that there's lots and lots of issues here around the things that block this, the fears that we have of others, the habits that we have of communication with others that don't work, the history we have with other people. All of this is true. I know that that's what you're thinking as well, that it's not so easy, especially with people that we have a history with. And, you know, we don't want to lose ourselves sometimes in the other. We just, you know, I don't want to lose myself in my mother-in-law, her craziness. I don't want to be, you know, there with my old Garin of school, or whatever, I don't know. You know, we can say, I don't want to lose myself in relationships with others that are difficult for me and make me pain. And if I was being mindful and going into their world, I would be kind of, I'm afraid of it. I don't want to be there. So there's a lot of boundaries. We need our boundaries in a way. But the truth is, in a way, we don't have a choice. And I'm sorry to say this, but we actually don't have a choice. Because we can't afford to keep up we can't afford to keep hold of a kind of spiritual isolation. Because it will just block us. even more. We will just feel more and more a sense that our Dharma life is a withdrawal life and protected. And that we go on retreats to be protected and we meditate to run away from life. And I know that all of you are kind of not really in that place that much, but it is something that we should be aware of, not to kind of define spirituality or inner growth as a form of withdrawal and escape and disconnection, which leads to more pain and more dukkha. And so finally, I want to say that, when we do this, but the moving out with our mindfulness and awareness, developing empathy, understanding where the blocks to empathy are, we develop a shirion pnimi, which is instead of a shirion chitzoni. The shirion pnimi is exactly that place of looking at this rather aggressive person or dog or difficult person or someone that doesn't understand us, and we can make the connection in some way or other through awareness. And when we make that connection, that's our shirion, because that we will understand that situation more. We will understand that person, this situation. We will understand how we are in it. Instead of a shirion that's shutting off, we have a shirion that's connecting. And it protects us. It's like being made of shakuf. Instead of having a shirion kazer chuma, we are shakuf. So things can't hurt us. They go through, you know, in the image of the Dharma. And it helps us to deal with suffering of ourselves and others. It's the basis, of course, to everything to do with helping others. The basis to, you know, sometimes I've been teaching courses of Livui Ruchani, people that say, I want to learn. There's a person who keeps calling me, which course is the best course to learn Livui Ruchani, Livui Ruchani? I want to help people who are dying. And he goes on and on and on and on. And I, the other day, I said to him, look, you don't even listen to me. So how can you listen to, you come, because he didn't stop talking, he didn't listen. He was like, I need this and I want to go this and I want to go in this course and which is the best course? And I was trying to tell him to be aware, to be mindful, to slow down, to listen. And then he'll be able to do Livui Ruchani. But he wasn't able to listen in the dialogue. He kept with his own chokhmot of how clever he was and how good he was and how much he would be good at Livui Ruchani. It's crazy. And I said, you know, first of all, you know, be aware, listen, and be empathic. And then all of that is easy. And so the compassion comes from there. And compassion, we'll talk more about this afternoon. And thank you.